This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
And welcome to the People Speak Radio. This is your host, David Swanson. We are live at the peoplespeakradio.net, and we are very privileged to have with us for the next hour John Dean, who is perhaps best known as a former legal counsel to the president when President Richard Nixon lived in the White House. John Dean was, at the age of 31, Chief Minority Counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives. He was the Associate Director of a Law Reform Commission, Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States, and again, he served as Richard Nixon's White House Attorney for 1,000 days. We know what came of that, but Mr. Dean has been the author of a number of books in recent years, many of them comparing the White House Watergate days to those of the Bush administration. One of them, in fact, that I liked quite a bit, called Worse Than Watergate, which I highly recommend. Other recent books include The Conservatives Without Conscience, which was also excellent, and a brand new book that I've not yet read that I'm hoping we can find out about called Broken Government. John Dean, welcome to the program.
Thank you, David. Actually, I did all those things before I was 31. I went to the White House at that age.
All of that stuff was before you were 31.
Right.
Okay. Well, you have to make me feel real bad now. but you've done a considerable amount of work since you were 31 as well, including...
Well, I promised myself when I retired, and I planned it by design, to go out and earn enough money so I could retire, to return to writing. And since retiring, I've cranked out 8 books in about 7 years.
Tell us very briefly why you would say something was worse than Watergate, because in the minds of at least some Americans, Watergate is an outrageous scandal, even if they aren't sure exactly what it was. And here we are with the wonderful, heroic wartime president who's perhaps unpopular, but not a criminal.
I used that title very sparingly, and I might have misused it, because it might have been a better title for the book, not just Worse Than Watergate, but Much Worse Than Watergate. And I say that because you can take Richard Nixon's litany of so-called abuses of power, and they're not comparable to what's happening today. I can't imagine Richard Nixon torturing anybody under any circumstances. I can't imagine the wholesale violation of the FISA law, which, you know, followed Watergate and was enacted really to deal with the, you know, sort of open philosophy of warrantless wiretapping that Nixon embraced, that it so exceeds anything Nixon in his wildest dreams ever conceived of, that it's much worse. And so it's for those reasons that I came up with that title. And also, the subtitle of the book tells you a lot about the book. It's The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. And the secrecy of this White House, really starting well before 9/11 and well before the so-called War on Terror, far exceeds anything of the deepest, darkest Nixonian secrecy that I was privy to.
Yeah, it's stunning to me, having been, you know, a little kid at that time, and having seen this presidency much more up close. Here we have what looks to me like complete disregard of the Congress, where they send requests and they're ignored and laughed at. They send FOIA requests and they're ignored and laughed at, and they shut down the office that handles them. They send subpoenas and they simply refuse to comply with the subpoenas. They send contempt citations and they refuse to enforce them. And yet the Congress won't use inherent contempt, won't impeach, won't take any steps that have any teeth to them, and it's as if they've sort of given up. Does that have anything to do with the title of your latest book, Broken
Government?
Well,
it does. It does indeed. It's one of the signs of the government being broken that the separations of powers no longer effectively check and balance. It's one of the reasons that we can be sure that people take the assessment they're taking of Congress, which in the latest polls I saw today that came out, the Rasmussen polls, showed that 9% of the people have respect for Congress and approve of what they're doing. 52% outright hostile towards what they're doing. And these are devastating numbers. We've never had a single-digit approval rating for Congress before, but they've earned it. And they've earned it when the Republicans controlled the Congress. They gave Bush and the Bush administration a pass. They couldn't spell the word oversight. They had forgotten about the founders' design of the system to check and balance. And that was understandable for partisan reasons. What's not understandable is the Democrats in there, while they have certainly improved, and a lot of people don't understand the improvements have been made because the Republicans have been so very good at making sure no one realizes they've actually done anything. They've bottled up all of the House-passed legislation. I guess 80, 90 bills are bottled up with threats of filibusters or other checks that the Senate has to stop legislation. So what the House has done has really accomplished little, although they have gone back to a full work week, which the Republicans had eliminated. They were down to a 3-day work week, and they have put some strictures back on travel and lobbying and other things of that nature. But the system is basically broken down because the separations of powers are not working.
Well, it was pretty clear coming into this Congress as of November 06 that there wasn't going to be much they could do. If they passed bills that this president didn't like, he would veto them, and they didn't have a big enough majority to override Republicans who would fall in line behind the president. If they passed bills that he liked part of them, he would use signing statements to rip out the sections of the new laws that he didn't feel inclined to comply with. And if they passed outrageous bills that stripped us of our rights, those might become law. And so a lot of us said, look, there are about two things this Congress can do. They can impeach, because the case is there and it can't be vetoed, and they can stop funding this war that they claim to want to end. And yet, of course, they've done neither of those things.
Let me pick up one of the points you made about the signing statements, for example. I'm not sure the president really can defy the law by issuing a signing statement. It's really, you can't have a pocket veto by inaction. The House Judiciary Committee is allegedly investigating whether all of these claims of failure or disinclination to enforce the law is actually being carried out by Bush or not. I don't know where that investigation is going. Like so many things that happen to be going on in this Congress, it just nothing seems to be surfacing to make this administration toe the line or make the checks and balances work. But you're right, there were two things, and it's understandable why they took impeachment off the table. I think a lot of people don't understand that the House Judiciary Committee, again, a committee to which I was the chief minority counsel, and John Conyers, who's now the chairman, came to that committee when I was committee counsel, and I've known John for years. He's a very able guy. But the House Judiciary Committee has never had the capability of running an impeachment investigation. If you look at every impeachment, from judges to presidents, they all rely on external investigations. When judges have been impeached, it's been because they've been in jail and already indicted. So there's a pretty good grand jury track record of what happened in an FBI investigation. And the presidents, you look at from Nixon to Clinton, where there were external investigations that the House could rely on. With Nixon, it was the Watergate special prosecutor. With Clinton, it was Ken Starr as an independent counsel. They relied on this. The House has no facility to investigate and undertake and provide a due process, if you will. While it's a political proceeding, it still inherently would have to be fair, and they just don't have the facilities to really investigate these things. And a president, as Nixon showed, will stiff-arm them if they ask for information. So So I've always been critical of the House and never setting up a permanent impeachment subcommittee, bipartisan, not outranked, you know, have a straight bipartisan where you have equal membership on both sides, the best and the brightest in the House on the committee, a bipartisan staff, and let them have a serious investigative capability where they can indeed enforce subpoenas themselves and not be confronted with a situation that Mukasey, Attorney General Mukasey, put them in when they refused to honor a contempt. And the House does have its own powers to hold a trial. In fact, I was talking, my wife and I were talking about this just yesterday with Roe still stiffing the House Judiciary Committee. She said, what's going to happen? I said, well, it could be some good summer theater if the House actually gets the backbone to hold a trial and they can indeed find him in contempt and can take action to protect their investigative powers and put him in jail. They can literally, they could make a lease arrangement with the District of Columbia, Northern Virginia, or someplace in Maryland, and incarcerate him.
Well, they could and they should, and John Conyers has threatened that rather half-heartedly off and on, and it sounds like Nancy Pelosi, among others, is quite opposed to taking that step. But you covered a lot of topics, and I'd love to just touch on signing statements quickly, because I assume most of our listeners have an idea what these are, where the president signs a bill into law and then publishes a little statement announcing which parts he's not inclined to comply with, which is, of course, unconstitutional. But there have been, over the past couple of years, a couple of studies by the Government Accountability Office, you know, taking a sample of Bush's signing statements and finding a significant percentage of them are laws where he, in fact, his administration has proceeded to violate those sections of law that he claimed the right to violate. So that when back in January of 2007, the Justice Department came in to Conyers' committee and said, oh, they're just press releases, they don't mean anything, that wasn't quite accurate, right? Here's an administration announcing it'll break the law, and in at least many cases proceeding to break it. I would agree with you that they don't have any legal or constitutional right to do that, but is it not fairly well established that they're doing it?
Well, I have not read that General Accountancy Office report. I've looked at some of the stuff they've published, and it's been a little vague to me as to, you know, other than requirements like reporting requirements, where the House or Senate say that the administration must submit information or reveal information. They've obviously taken a tough line on that. In fact, Cheney took that to court and won in court because he had some nicely, freshly appointed Bush judges who agreed totally that the presidency ought to be able to operate in secret without Congress asking for this sort of information. There were some other technical problems with the case as well. But it's less than clear the extent and the width and breadth of this. I think that, yes, he's clearly, when he says, and a lot of this stuff has been cranked right through the vice president's office. I was surprised that when David Addington was before the House Judiciary Committee, they didn't get more into signing statements because his office has really been the sponsor of these.
What about torture as the most famous case of a signing statement? Here we have a bill passed criminalizing torture as if it had ever been legal, and the president writing a signing statement giving him the right to continue to torture, which it's very well documented they have continued to do.
Interesting question. How do you prove it?
How do you prove that they're torturing?
Yeah.
Well, we've had victims of torture actually come into Congress. We have numerous reports and photographs and accounts and books. You can fill a library now with just the accounts.
Well,
from the victims.
I've read some of that stuff, and every time you raise it, the administration denies it and says, oh, we didn't torture this person. They're exaggerating. They're making this up. We're confronted with this right now with people coming out of Guantanamo who some are trying to actually sue for having been tortured, and the administration just denying it. How do you prove it's their word against the administration's, and they're wrapping it in state secrets? There are all kinds of problems with proving it. I don't doubt that they're torturing. I don't think people would make this up, and particularly the renditions that have been carried on, where the government has just stiffed the Canadian fellow, for example, who was rendered to... But they're very difficult. You know, it's one thing to make an allegation in a newspaper. It's something else to literally go into court and make the case when they've got the state secrets privilege, they've got it's their word against an alleged terrorist or detainee, and it gets pretty tough. Question is, how do you enforce this? Now, if Obama is going to be true to his word, and what he's made a statement on the campaign, I actually cited it in my last column at FindLaw, when I finally tracked it down, he made it to a very reputable, well-known, sophisticated political journalist from Philadelphia, in the Philadelphia Daily News, where he was asked in the context of torture and war crimes, what are you going to do about this if you're elected president? And he said, well, I will immediately have my attorney general investigate as to whether this has been just bad policy or blatant criminal violations. And if it's been the latter, we will take appropriate action. I'm not, you know, that's the potential cure. There's a 5-year statute of limitations on some of these, even have longer statute of limitations. It's clear the Bush administration isn't going to do anything, including providing any information. But a grand jury, when they're out of power, is a little tougher to control. And so that's the hope to get to the bottom of this, is if Obama is elected and he is a man of his word, then he would go after these people.
Well, I certainly hope so, and hope is, of course, his big theme. But I do think the case may be a little stronger than you suggest. Most of the alleged victims of torture claiming they've been tortured are no longer either detainees or alleged terrorists, but individuals who've been declared innocent and allowed to leave. Some of them
right.
Declared innocent years before they were allowed to leave. But in any case, we also, of course, have photos and documentation from Abu Ghraib, at least, and somebody has considerably more of those than the public has yet seen. So we don't know exactly what evidence is available, but I think the question about Obama is an interesting one, and I want to get to, but I want to let people know how they can get in on this conversation. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio, and we are speaking with John Dean, former counsel to the president under Richard Nixon and author most recently of Broken Government, and also the author of numerous columns that you can find at findlaw.com, FINDLAW, findlaw.com. You can get in on this conversation toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. Call us up with your questions for John Dean. Anywhere else in the world, call in at 877-489-6350, 877-489-6350, or go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and send us your questions through the chat room. The interesting thing about Obama, I think, is that he told that Philadelphia Daily News reporter, look, I don't know that any crimes have been committed, and I'm going to have my attorney general look into whether any crimes have been committed. At the same time, he sends his supporters on his website through his email blasts announcements that when he is president, he will cease any longer to continue this illegal, warrantless wiretapping and so forth. Out of one side of his mouth, he announces a number of crimes that he will cease committing. Out of the other side of his mouth, he says, well, the reason I'm not for impeachment and I'm not for prosecution until after I've looked into whether there have been any crimes committed is I haven't heard about any crimes having been committed. How do you make sense of that?
Well, I think that's being a cautious politician. I think he would be criticized, and maybe rightly so, if he declared somebody guilty of a crime without the actual evidence in front of him or having developed it. I don't think there's any doubt that we all believe this runs right to either the vice president's office or the president's office. But who knows? Maybe they've insulated themselves. Maybe they have deniability. Maybe it can never be proven. Maybe the so-called national security defense will actually be considered a legitimate offense or defense by the court. It hasn't in the past, but it could well be when a president asks somebody to do something. There is certainly a law enforcement long-held defense. If a policeman, you arrive at the scene of an accident, asks you to go grab that guy, and you do it, and he accuses you of assault, you're protected by that acting and for that policeman and his aid. And the same, really, you can escalate that up to the level of the president. If he asks somebody to break a law, theoretically, they're immune from prosecution for that. That's a, you know, it's a potential defense, but it takes a pretty clear line of authority, we know, to have that actually be implemented. And it's theoretically possible that when, you know, a court could say, when the president does it and believes he's acting in the national security, it's not a crime.
Well, then I guess Senator Obama should stop announcing that he will cease committing such crimes, if they might not be crimes. I mean, it just seems...
Well, there's certainly prima facie violations of the FISA law, for example. We don't have any question, nor do we have any question that torture is not a legal proceeding. And I don't think he's saying that as a matter of policy, he will not engage in those activities. And that's where when I read that statement from Philadelphia with his hedge, that is it a misguided policy or is it a blatant violation of the law, that is sort of a hedge. If it's people who are acting at the president's behest, he may claim that's a belated, you know, a misguided policy and not just somebody, violating the law wantonly. This whole area of national security is very gray. That's one of the unfortunate things with Nixon never going to trial for an impeachment, because a lot of the action that Nixon took literally was, in his mind, done for the national security. A number of the wiretaps that he implemented on staff and in newsmen, the break-in into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, which Nixon was never sure whether he had or had not authorized, he certainly claimed that it was worth covering up and keeping buried and obstructing justice for national security reasons. He believed the fact that, you know, that the Russians might be somehow involved in this was a legitimate national security issue at the time. But it never got litigated because he never went to trial in the Senate, and the Senate would have made often, you know, in making a judgment on this, even the House, if they'd have carried forward with a bill of impeachment, they would have been some parameters on what is legitimate national security action and what is just an abuse of power.
And yet it seems that the FISA court's history is one of rather broadly interpreting things as in the national security interest. So that
they've never found anything outside the national security interest, have they? I guess twice they've turned down applications.
So if the president had gone through the legal channels, he would more than likely have gotten approval of anything that was actually or even remotely in the national security interest. Instead, he did something that we know began long before September 11th, and that we know that even John Ashcroft on his hospital bed wouldn't approve of. And yet, if the Senate does what it's expected to do, I guess tomorrow or so, we may never find out exactly what the crimes are that we are throwing immunity at. How important?
Well, now wait a minute. On that, on the immunity only runs to civil immunity to the telecoms, not to either government employees or criminal immunity.
I understand, but what justification can there be for that civil immunity for telecoms, and why isn't it the responsibility of the Senate and the House to find out what was done at the behest of the president and by the president?
Well, I think it is. The claim, when I've raised this with some members of the House, they said, well, we've been assured by the heads of our intelligence committee, the ranking member and the chairman, that they have been advised what's going on here. So we're relying on their good faith that we know what's actually going on. I doubt that they'd have a clue what's really going on. We don't know what the administration told them or didn't tell them.
Right.
But this is when you have a spineless Congress, what can happen?
Well, we have people sending in questions for you, John Dean, through our website, thepeoplespeakradio.net. And Alan in Canada is asking, Not long ago, Bush admitted to the high crime of illegal wiretaps. Given this admission, do we need any investigation? Can we not throw him out of office?
Well, actually, the first time he did make that admission, I happened to be with Barbara Boxer, interviewing her at a program the day that happened. And I said he was the first president I'd ever heard of who admitted an impeachable offense. Unfortunately, there actually is a process you have to go through, and that happened when the Republicans controlled the House. Yes, you would have to, you know, if you started an impeachment proceeding on that, I think it'd be great to do if he wants to admit that he is above the law, above the FISA law. Let's test it. Let's test, make a political issue of it and test it. But Pelosi won't have anything to do with it. The writer, the emailer, makes a real good point if he's done this. And he's also admitted other high crimes and misdemeanors.
He has, indeed. I love the idea of a permanent committee or subcommittee to address impeachment, but I wonder why a special committee or a judiciary committee couldn't take up impeachment of this president, given that they have 6 or 7 months and nothing else to do with their time, and impeach him in an hour.
Here's what would, as a practical matter, happen. You could probably get a majority of the House to vote impeachment send the bill over to the Senate, but the problem is you'd never get two-thirds in the Senate, which you need to impeach. You didn't have the votes.
Well, I have a problem with making that prediction in such black and white terms when the House could hold hearings on some of this evidence and sway public opinion and the opinions of...
Now, wait a minute. You were saying we'd do it without evidence. I'm telling you that they have no capability to really undertake these hearings, and the administration will not cooperate. They're going to claim this is all national security information. We won't get into it. We won't explain it. That's why the House voted largely on the FISA amendments, not knowing what they're even voting on. So they would blanket this whole thing with secrecy and say, we can't even talk about it. So you can't hold a hearing. So you work on the assumption of an admission against interest. The man has admitted he's committed a blatant crime. Let him offer the defense of that, which is as the commander in chief, he has the legal power to ignore the law, which is a very, very specious argument. But let him make it and test it and put it to a test. And then I'm saying you would never get the votes in the Senate, even if you did get the votes to send a bill of impeachment over.
Well, I would quibble with the prediction, but even assuming that prediction, if the House
you got 49 Republicans.
I understand that they have to get reelected too. Enough, 11 or so of them have to get reelected who could be swayed potentially. But let's just assume they can't be. Let's assume it has to fail in the Senate. If the House were to impeach, even without a conviction in the Senate, it would establish a certain precedent, and as long as the House doesn't impeach, I think you'll agree, they don't have any teeth with which to get enforcement of these lesser measures, so they send subpoenas and have them laughed at. One of the articles, as you know, passed against Nixon in the Judiciary Committee was for refusal to comply with a subpoena.
Right.
Were they to begin to impeach over this refusal to comply with oversight, one possible outcome is that they begin to get some compliance with oversight, which then provides yet more evidence.
Well, I think it will be a travesty if they don't enforce these subpoenas. If they let Rove et al. And Harriet Myers and Bolton and others just throw their nose up at the Congress and walk away unscathed, untouched, that they will damage the checks and balance system they will change American government into an elected monarchy for all practical purposes.
Exactly.
It's an uncheckable presidency at that point.
And how do they enforce those subpoenas other than
impeachment? They have their own trial. They have the power. They used to do this. One looks at the Jefferson Manual, which governs the proceedings of the House and Senate to this day. And you look in the in the rules of the House, and there are many precedents in there for actually holding trials, convicting people of contempt of Congress, and putting them in prison.
But it seems to me that the only reason we have Mukasey, right, is that there was a movement to impeach Gonzalez, and he jumped on a plane and left. And so we put in another guy who's just a Xerox copy of Gonzalez, whereas the guys at the top giving the orders are untouchable because they're not about to drag Cheney or Bush in for a trial.
Well, you're right, but you've got to start somewhere. And, you know, for example, I've long said, while it's one thing to overturn an election, which is what you do when you impeach a president, it's something else to impeach somebody like a David Addington, who is clearly has no interest in complying with the Constitution, is pushing radical theories of how to interpret the Constitution, and somebody young enough that he will probably end up in government again. You can impeach somebody like that, and you can keep that person out of government.
Well, I'm all for it, don't get me wrong. I'm just afraid that President Obama or whoever, or McCain or whoever comes after them and after them will understand that they can break any laws they want, and the worst possible punishment is that a few of their underlings get impeached. And I'm not...
Well, that's one of the... You know, I thought one of the lessons of Watergate was that what the kinds of things that Nixon engaged in would never happen again. Now they're not only happening, they're happening in a much more severe degree.
Yes.
And this is really what the Bush administration has accomplished. There will be a snapback. I don't think, if the American people don't get exhausted with a spineless Congress soon, they will. At some point, enough people will become alarmed at how a bunch of wusses are running the legislative branch, as well as a bunch of tyrants running the executive branch. They'll take action, but we have to hope not too much damage is done in the interim.
Well, I agree. We've got people starting to call in, so I'd like to bring people in on this conversation with John Dean and see if we can't figure out a way to save this republic before it's too late. You can join us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. Anywhere else, 877-489-6350. We have Rain from Richmond, Virginia on the line. Thanks for calling in to the People Speak Radio.
Well, thanks for being able to take my call. Thank you, Mr. Dean. You're responsible. No, I'm kidding. Responsible for me not watching Gilligan's Island and Lost in Space and all of these shows that I wanted to watch when I was a kid. But the Watergate hearings were on television, accessible to everyone that had a television with bunny rabbit ears or whatever they were called. Now we're on cable. In February, we go to some other thing that a lot of people will be excluded from even getting television. With the throwing away of the Fairness Doctrine, there are so many people that don't know what's going on. I mean, to have C-SPAN to watch hearings costs, over $40 in my neighborhood. Do you think that might be a reason why more people aren't involved and standing up for impeachment or change in their local government because they just don't know what's going on? The mainstream media, I used to call it, now I'm calling it the corporate fawning media, is not covering things. There was a station here in Virginia that did a news report on Bush going to Monticello that didn't even cover the protests of Bush at that event. So I just would like your take on that. We had access to news in the past, and it seems like we really don't have that anymore unless we can be on the Internet and pay a big cable bill. I'd like your thoughts. Thank you.
Yeah, there's good no question. How does the media compare now and then?
Well, it's sadly the comparison. It has become, there's no question that voter and public interest and knowledge has always been bad. You look back to the time that Americans first started polling, and about a third of the public has any knowledge of what's really going on, and that's of varying degrees of strength. And so this has been rather consistent for the most modern and advanced of democracies. We have probably the least voter and citizen participation of any country in the world. Our voting is in the tank. We're down there somewhere below Zambia as far as the number of people. That's been one of the exciting things about the primaries this year with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama getting a lot of new voters interested, which is encouraging. I have taught for years over, I'm a lecturer over at the University of Southern California at the Annenberg School, and I've noticed a distinct trend of the students becoming more interested and more sophisticated each, in about the last 5 years, they've gotten much more interested. So maybe we're in a swing where they're getting interested. But the broader question of how do people stay informed when the so-called mainstream media doesn't cover things, you hit on the other thing that encourages me. Yes, that's a problem, and I've asked and explored. It's one of the reasons I write the books I write, because I ask people in the Washington Press Corps in particular, why don't you cover this? Why, when I was writing Worse Than Watergate, I was asking, why in the world are you people letting this president get away with this secrecy? And to give you a capsule answer of talking to an awful lot of Washington journalists, came up with really the following. It's sort of a conflation of three things. First of all, there's been a generational change in the press corps in Washington. I'm not sure some of them, while there's some very bright people, a lot of them probably couldn't tell you which came first, Teapot Dome or Watergate. They would not be able to, and Iran-Contra may be something they've never even heard of. So this younger generation doesn't have its antenna quivering when some of these things happen, although some of the old-timers who are still there will tell you that it even runs deeper, that particularly with the Bush administration, they've been particularly effective at stiff-arming the news media. They punish them when they write a story they don't want. They cut them off from access, and editors don't want to hear reporters' excuses about why they can't get more than what's being handed out of the trough. They want results, or they'll get another reporter to go on the case. And so this makes these people shy about doing things. I'll give you a good example. One of the old hands told me that he almost broke out laughing when he went to what was about Bush's third or fourth press conference in the East Room, which he now doesn't do at all anymore. But that was the long tradition to have the press corps in and have a press conference. He said, we were walked into the East Room two by two like kindergarten. And we were given assigned seats. And he said it soon flashed on us all exactly what was happening, that before going to the press conference, we had to give R.A. Fleischer a list of three questions that we'd ask if we were called on. And we didn't get access if we didn't give the questions. So it became clear that the president had a seating chart at the podium. He knew exactly who would ask what question, so the whole thing was literally scripted. I said, well, why didn't you write a report on it? He said, well, because myself, like others, wanted to continue to get some access. And that was, you write that report and you'd burn your bridge. And it was a hell of a story, much more story the way the press conference was handled than anything came out of the press conference. So that's another problem. But the overriding all this has also been, particularly with the print media, I wondered if corporate consolidation resulted in the Republican base of the corporation, so to speak, not being happy with stories that enterprising investigative reporters might be digging up. And I found not a single person told me they'd ever had a story spike. To the contrary, they said what's happened is we just don't have time given what's on our plate because newsrooms are getting so cut back in size. And this has been going on in a steady stream where fewer and fewer and fewer people are in newsrooms. I occasionally visit newsrooms around the country when I'm out with my books, and it's amazing that these places are, you know, you may find a half a dozen people in a room that can handle 50, 60 reporters, if that. And so this has affected the ability to dig these stories out. A lot of reporters said, John, if we had the kind of time you have, we could dig out the kind of information you're digging out, but we don't. Bob Woodward, a well-known investigative journalist, doesn't work at the paper for good reason. He spends all of his time doing the digging for his books, and he just shares it with the Post. He's no longer at the Post, but that's what he did when he had the arrangement there. So those things have kind of come together and really weakened the coverage of the news media. The only thing encouraging I can give you, on the other hand, is the medium we're on right now, and that's the Internet. It's getting more and more available to more and more people. It's coming slowly but surely, almost a universal access. Hopefully we'll have it. Everybody will be able to have broadband so they can get to it. And there is good reporting going on. A lot of reporters who otherwise would be in a newsroom are now finding they can actually survive doing news-gathering blogs. Some of them just do analysis on other reporting. But take the agencies and departments in Washington. They used to all have a press corps on each department. The Justice Department had a group, the State Department, the Defense. Now, very few of the, particularly the regulatory agencies, have any regular reporter covering them on a steady basis. This is where the blogs, where people who know and understand these departments and agencies and how they operate are covering them and doing much better jobs than would, say, a reporter who just dropped by once a week to pick up the press releases. So there's negatives and there's positives, and I happen to be more optimistic than pessimistic. But no Pollyanna either.
three cheers for the Internet, and I would say for progressive radio shows and for books. You know, I mean, with the New York Times held off on the FISA story, on the warrantless spying story, and admitted that they did so because it might affect an election, and then finally published it because the reporter was about to print it in a book, a book which revealed several other important stories that have yet to make it into the New York Times. So books are serving that purpose, and John Dean, you have a book out called Broken Government that I hope everyone will pick up. But there are endless news stories that we can't get into the news, and it took shutting down American media outlets with phone calls and emails before they would write about the Downing Street Minutes, which they just had to take from every newspaper outside of this country and copy the story. You know, that these reporters in the White House press corps, who back in January of 2003, when Blair was at the White House and Bush and Blair gave them a little show about how they were trying to achieve peace and hoping to hold off war and so on, and many months later this memo comes out about how they had been in a room with Bush proposing wild-eyed ideas for how they might be able to provoke a war, including painting U.S. Colors on U.N. planes and flying them low and trying to get them shot at, and not a single one of those reporters is embarrassed or angry or goes back and asks a question after the fact. So something is indeed broken, maybe even in the Fourth Estate. We have to take a quick break, but I want to try to get one more caller in. First, we have Samantha from Texas. You're on with John Dean. Samantha from Texas, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, John, I've heard that Bush has bought property in Paraguay. Do you think that Mr. Bush would flee the country if impeachment or prosecution became too close for comfort?
Good question. I understand his daughter's doing some of the work on that on those property acquisitions for him. And I don't know what Uruguay's extradition treaties look like. Maybe he had Alberto Gonzalez check that out for him, and that's maybe where Alberto's hiding out these days. Anyway, I don't think that Bush is ever going to be held accountable for war crimes. I think some of the members of this administration, however, who don't have the same kind of immunity that a head of state does, will be careful some of the countries they travel to in the future, because they well could be confronted with a charge of a war crime.
Yeah, and sadly for Mr. Bush's plans, Paraguay has seen a recent election shift that government from his friends to some who might actually prosecute him there. So there is hope for us. We have to take a quick break. This is the People Speak Radio at thepeoplespeakradio.net, and we will be back in very few minutes with John Dean.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
This land is yours.
Join us on the People Speak radio show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
Maybe you and me.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contributes to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit sosmorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This land is yours. This land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
And we are back at the People Speak Radio, which you can find at thepeoplespeakradio.net. You can go there and send in your questions for John Dean, who is with us for another 10 or 12 minutes. You can also call in toll-free at 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. If you are outside the U.S. and Canada, 877-489-6350. While we were on break, I believe a call came in. Zanya from Virginia, you are on with John Dean.
Okay, this is Zanya from Virginia.
Okay. Hi, thanks for calling.
Mr. Dean, I am so happy to have you and to see you give your apology, so to speak, on the news every evening when I watch television as you gave your testimony against Nixon during the Watergate trials. I just wish there had been, for example, that a feeling of like a Colin Powell or maybe even a Condoleezza Rice would have had during this mad running up to the Iraqi war. What I'm wondering also, Mr. Dean, is how do you think we as people, I am an activist, but how do you think that we as people can do what Paul Revere and the others did maybe a long time ago when there were actually militias or people who could go out and maybe do something to make the government change? How can we do that when most communication systems are lost to the masses of the people and there's information today even on the internet about the dumbing down of certain generations of our people? How can we, do you think, make a change? And there's another question that I have for a friend of mine do you think that Nancy Pelosi has overstepped her mandate by saying that we cannot impeach?
Okay. We there?
I think the caller hung up, but there were a couple of good questions there.
Yeah, there were good questions. Let me take first the Pelosi question. I think she's concerned about the politics of impeachment. The impeachment drive to, come hell or high water, tarnish Bill Clinton certainly left a lot of bad tastes in the mouths of people who watch Washington. And while the Republicans only paid a partial price for that, some more than others, and some not enough, I think she wanted to avoid being just plain impeachment politics. And probably, given the time allotted of this administration, and impeachment is really a tool to get people out who may cause damage, it was probably a smart move. I can understand why people would feel passionately the other way, but just knowing the way Washington works, I can certainly understand it. Now, the other question about what people can do, well, you know, obviously those who follow a radio show like this are activists, they're involved, they're interested, they're educating themselves, and that's a great key. About 2 out of 5 people can tell you how many branches of government we have. And those people are really cues for others. You influence other people. They may not follow your advice always, but they'll listen to your opinion. So you can, by just becoming knowledgeable, affect the process, and you can also excite other people to get interested and knowledgeable. And we're not going to make it if more people do not do what people who follow a show like this do, and that is to make themselves aware. And so that's the best way you can spread the word, is share your interest and concerns, and hope that it's an infection that spreads.
Very well said. And may I add, go to my website, afterdowningstreet.org or impeachcheney.org, and see what you can do to push your congressmember, push your local media, push your neighbors and friends. And on Thursday, Congressman Kucinich will introduce yet another article of impeachment against the president. Call the media, call your congressmember, make news out of it, influence your friends and neighbors, as John Dean has said. Here we have a question sent in through our chat room. John from the Canadian Rockies asks, I guess, a couple of questions. Mr. Dean, my memory may be foggy, but do you agree that had Nixon gone to jail, we would not be in this crisis of abuse of authority? Do you feel at all responsible, and what would you have done differently?
Well, you know, whether Nixon going to jail or not, I couldn't wish anybody having to go to jail. I think it probably would have brought a lot more closure had he been indicted and had to stand trial and then been pardoned. You know, obviously a president in jail is not a very healthy situation given the national security implications of that. And Nixon obviously suffered plenty just by having to resign. But Ford didn't permit the closure. He obviously paid for that, and the country paid for it. There's now a great effort, because a lot of the information was left dangling and open, that people are trying to rewrite history. There are Nixon apologists out there who want to have it a much different story go down in the history books than what actually happened, and they may well succeed. Who knows?
I guess it depends who gets to write the history books. Let's go to Will from Brooklyn. Thanks for calling the People Speak Radio.
Yes, John Dean. I wanted to know if you know if the Inspector General, Glenn Fine, he found that late payments have resulted in telecommunications carriers actually disconnecting phone lines established to deliver surveillance results to the FBI, resulting in lost evidence, including an instance where delivery of intercept information required by a FISA order was halted. So I just wanted to understand, why should we reward telephone executives who put their bottom line before our security?
Well, if they are legitimately charged by the president to do something and are expected to do it, their bottom line shouldn't impede that. Whatever Fine is a very cautious, careful, well-respected lawyer, and he doesn't reach conclusions without them being well-founded. So these are troublesome questions, and I'm not sure, for example, if the civil litigation were ever to go forward and the immunity bill not passed, we'd ever get to the bottom. Some courts have declared that they will dismiss these cases based on state secrets. We know the administration would fight tooth and nail to keep this information from surfacing. So I'm not sure that, you know, it wouldn't be a highly protracted, maybe 20 years of litigation before we'd ever get to the bottom of it, and then it would be too late to help solve any problems.
Well, we've got a few minutes left in this show, sadly, but let me try this one more time. Wouldn't they also fight tooth and nail to avoid impeachment, even if they thought they were guaranteed acquittal in the Senate? And so might they not turn over some evidence rather than run up against impeachment? And second part of the question, might that not be actually smart politics for the Democrats? Having made this exact same argument during Iran-Contra, let's set it aside, let's avoid impeachment, let's win the elections, and then having lost the elections. And in fact, you look at about 220 years of that sort of story of Congress, of a party in Congress that stands up for the Constitution tending to win, and one that doesn't tending to lose. And even in the case of Clinton, you know, the Republicans lost a few seats in the Senate, which had acquitted and held on to both houses and the White House. And you saw Al Gore running for president, pretending he'd never met Bill Clinton in his life. That sort of defensiveness as a result of the Republicans going on the offense. Might the
Republicans
Democrats
are much better at this than Democrats. I think the record shows that. They have always been good at attacking, not terribly good at governing. That's the bottom line in my Broken Government book, that while they're able to rule, they don't really govern. And they're much better when they're out of office and attacking others than when they're in, because all they know how to do is attack when they're in. That doesn't help the climate. You know, another impeachment proceeding at this point isn't going to help the climate in Washington, which is in dire condition. What we have to worry about, if McCain arrives come next January, we're all in a whole heap of trouble. The Republicans know how to, they're not going to win the Congress. They're not going to win control back of the Congress. Somebody's got to help give the Democrats some spine. Now, maybe an impeachment drill would give them that, but I doubt that it's not going to happen while Pelosi's speaker. That's clear. She's just not going to let it get on the table. I would settle to see them enforce their subpoenas, and if they don't do that, you might as well write the Congress off.
Well, if they do that, inherent contempt, send out the sergeant-at-arms, hold their own trials, and or they do impeachment hearings on things like torture, forcing McCain to go out there and explain why he was against torture, then he was for it, etc., on spying, making McCain speak to his multiple positions on each of these crimes, how could he hope to then be elected president?
Well, I don't think he, obviously, if you started hearings now, McCain's not going to testify.
Testify, but have to speak to the number one topic in the news, which is what it would be.
Question whether you could even get the, as I say, you're just not going to get enough Democrats behind this to bring it up to be the dominant issue. There are too many other, the economy is of much greater concern, gas prices. If they held serious hearings on what's happening to oil, I think you'd get a lot of people paying attention. You've got to remember the ratings on the hearings during the Clinton impeachment were in the tank. People were not interested in the Clinton impeachment, even though it involves sex. So if you can't draw a crowd with that, you're not going to draw much public attention when you get into what would be dense areas of national security.
Well, you've had polls showing a majority for impeachment of Bush and Cheney for years prior to Congress doing anything at all, whereas with Clinton, the public was against it from the get-go and never came around. And so it would seem to be two different questions. But let's close with this very short and cryptic question sent in from Steve in New Mexico. What about justice?
What about justice? The Department of Justice?
I don't know.
Or the concept of justice?
It's capitalized. It's open to your interpretation.
Well, the Department of Justice is in deep trouble. I have friends who've been there for years who've left because of the politicalization of the department. Some of them are actually on leave, and they will come back if a Democrat is elected and they get back to normal operating procedure, which is a nonpartisan department. The greater term of justice, that certainly is going to have to be addressed by history as to whether you can do what this administration has done and get away with it, and whether there is justice.
And that's the big question. John Dean, thank you so very much for joining us on the People Speak Radio. We very much appreciate your time.
Keep up your good work, David.
You too. And everyone go out and get a copy of the latest book, Broken Government. And if you haven't yet, go get a copy of Worse Than Watergate, which is my favorite, and pick up Conservatives Without a Conscience as well. Wonderful writing by John Dean, who's contributing to the discussion and the debate long after he became famous under a White House that was better than this one. Join us also tomorrow night on the People Speak Radio when my guest at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time will be former federal prosecutor Elizabeth De La Vega, who has a different take on how we might hold George W. Bush and gang accountable. And remember to go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and contribute what you can in financial support to keep this show online and coming to you through the Internet. We appreciate your support. We need it. We depend on it. ThePeopleSpeakRadio.net. This is David Swanson. Speak with you again tomorrow night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall by the relief fountain, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.
Killing commonplace. To find out more about Almeen and her work for the Mother Goddess of All Life, visit spiritualjourneys.com. As a Toltec Nahual, Almeen leads a life dedicated to setting others free from illusion, and her insights into cosmology and man's role in the macrocosm are undeniably groundbreaking. Sunday nights at 8:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, tune into Windows into Eternity for the most cutting-edge discussion of ascension one can find.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to Dr. Fred Bell in the Health and Sciences Show on VBSRadio.com. Tune in or be tuned out.
This is Mark Marshall, and I'm proud to say that my music is being played here on the 24-hour music channel at bbsradio.com, where there's anything but the mainstream, and they truly do love independent music. You can find out more about me at markmarshall.com, and stay tuned to BBS Radio.
Stumbling, mumbling something about different points of view.